The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to begin with a story by Jordan Salema, What I Found Searching for My Family Story. Now, this appeared in the December 2024 issue of National Geographic. As the editors note, documents and genealogies are helpful, but personal memories are invaluable. And as you're going to hear, this is more than just a family history. It reveals how travel can play an important role in family generations, stories that reveal life's story, so to speak. Now let's hear Jordan's story. The binder stared back at me. Yellowing papers and black-and-white photographs spilled out on its sides. In handwritten Spanish, the label on its spine read, Historia Antigua, Ancient History. I opened it to the first page and began to read. I'm not sure what it is that I'm about to write, but I've had this idea for a number of years now, ever since a conversation I had with my father when I turned 13 and had my bar mitzvah. This was clearly my grandfather's handwriting, a characteristically Argentine script, marked by irregular capitalization. It was Thanksgiving, and I was in my grandmother's basement in the suburbs outside of New York City. As I read on in silence, I could hear my extended family ambling about upstairs. Within the first few pages of the binder, Abuelo had recounted centuries of our family's history, touching Mesopotamia, medieval Spain, Ottoman Syria, Latin America, and the United States, as it had all been told to him by his father. What I held in my hands was an oral history, and Abuelo was the first to write it down. As I gently flipped through the rest, I found diaries, travelogues, letters and news clippings from Abuelo's own youth, a treasure trove of recollections, remembrance, and research. For several months, I didn't tell him what I'd found in his basement. Instead, I would look forward to college breaks and holidays at my grandparents' house when I could quietly slip away from the crowd to go downstairs and read more. One afternoon, months after I'd first found the binder, Abuelo came into the kitchen and motioned for me to follow him. "I want to show you something," he said. He led me to the basement, and as we turned left toward his library, I saw that the Historia Antigua was already opened on the desk. My face flushed. "You've been looking at my writing," Abuelo says. My grandfather always spoke so matter-of-factly in English, carefully choosing his words. "Yes, I have," I said. "Abuelo, it's very interesting." His face broke into a wide smile. He began to laugh as he spoke, and his eyes welled up with tears. "How much have you read?" "Not much," I lied. We sat down in front of the desk. Abuelo thumbed through the binder past religious documents, a ketubah, or Jewish marriage contract, and a past civil documents, faded registry from Buenos Aires, and he began to tell me the family history. From that day on, we mostly read the Historia Antigua together so that Abuelo could explain the parts I didn't understand, names and places, words and phrases in Spanish and Arabic and Hebrew. We discussed language, identity, and history. We drew and redrew family trees and reviewed the names and backstories of ancestors as though they'd be coming over at any moment. These conversations drifted completely into Spanish. It was easier for Abuelo to talk about his life, especially his childhood in Buenos Aires, in his native language. For me, it lent a sense of excitement and even mystery to know the conversations, sort of like unlocking a new world. As both a grandson and a journalist, I tried to ask questions that brought color and nuance to these histories. Since the Historia Antigua already covered the basics, the what, where, and when of my family story, at least in broad strokes, I could focus on the why and the how to paint a portrait of our wandering family. Why did my Jewish great-grandparents leave Damascus in such a hurry at the start of the 20th century, bound for Argentina? Why did my great-grandfather decide to work as a traveling salesman with a horse-drawn cart in the remote Andes Mountains? And how did he go about his journeys? How did abuelo and abuela spend the days of their childhood in the working-class neighborhoods of Buenos Aires? And why did our family end up migrating again, this time to the U.S. and across the Americas? Though it might be hard to believe that abuelo hadn't shared these stories with me before, I wasn't necessarily surprised. My grandfather was never one to launch into a family tale unprompted, but then again, I had never taken the time to ask. Whenever I told friends and others about our conversations, this last sentiment was repeated back to me. "It's amazing that you took the time to ask," people said, lamenting that they hadn't yet done the same or didn't think to do it until it was too late. Recently, I began leading family history workshops and traveling the country to discuss a book I wrote about my search across Argentina for traces of abuelo's father, that Syrian Jewish traveling salesman in the Andes Mountains. What I've realized by talking with others is that time and inertia remain our biggest barriers to hearing our own stories. By the time the guardians of the answers are gone, we are more likely to be left with heaps of documents to sort through, birth certificates, DNA results, unlabeled photographs, rather than hours of stories, the where and when, but not the how and why. For those of us still in the lucky position to do so, we must ask questions of our parents and grandparents now before it's too late. Keep journals, write letters, make lists of sensory details, ask about otherwise ordinary objects around the house that could contain clues about the past. Record and transcribe kitchen table conversations, or if those conversations aren't happening naturally, organize talk show style interviews between older and younger relatives with the rest of the family as the audience. If you're of an older generation, it is your turn to speak. Think about how you can make these stories come alive in your own families and what sorts of tools like abuelo's thick, mysterious Historia Antigua you can use to light sparks of interest among your younger relatives as well as yourself. Family stories are currency for survival. They are embedded within the traditions we pick up along the journeys of our lives. They are the identities we create in worlds foreign and familiar, remembered now but forever at risk of being forgotten. A while after abuelo and I began discussing the Historia Antigua, abuelo revealed her own secret collection of stories, short fictions inspired by her childhood, which she'd filed away in the back of her recipe binder. Now, as a family, we often read and discuss those, too. Quite an interesting little story there. Well, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, before I get into that, I want to tell you that abuelo, it means grandfather, and his real name is Moises Salema, okay? And abuela, of course, means grandmother. Now, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, thousands of people were inspired by the news that the badly fire-damaged Notre Dame Cathedral of Paris had been restored and reopened. And there was a lot of coverage of this. The story, Resurrecting Notre Dame, that we're going to read, is written by Robert Kunzik. It appeared in the December 2024 issue of National Geographic. Now, just to refresh your memory quickly, the blaze that nearly destroyed Notre Dame occurred 5 years ago. Kunzik reveals how the astonishing restoration was pulled off and how a sense of sacredness was rekindled. So this is going to be quite a story that we're going to tell. And so let us begin. The fire that came close to destroying the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris started under the roof in the ancient wooden attic near the base of the spire. It began a little after 6 p.m. on April 15, 2019, the Monday of Holy Week, 6 days before Easter. Inside the church, a mass was underway. My wife and I had arrived in the city the day before, and at around 7 that Monday evening, we just happened to be passing by. From the window of our cab on the Pont Saint-Michel, we caught sight of a flickering patch of orange on the roof. Minutes later, stopped in traffic, we saw flames shoot up the wooden spire. Disbelief gave way to shock. Notre Dame was really burning. No cathedral is more important to France or to the world. For more than 800 years, Notre Dame has stood at the center of French life and has been setting for historic events, both religious and secular. In 1239, King Louis IX, also known as Saint Louis, delivered what was purported to be Jesus' crown of thorns to the cathedral. In 1944, as German bullets were still flying outside, General Charles de Gaulle attended a mass to celebrate the liberation of Paris. Through it all, Notre Dame largely escaped the bombs and blazes that ravaged other cathedrals. An island of stability in a sea of change, it became one of the world's most visited monuments, as well as a place millions hold sacred. When we returned to the scene later that evening, the spire had fallen and the lead roof had melted. From the darkness on the right bank, we gazed at the stone gable of the north transept, and through the small rose window we saw flames consuming the oak roof trusses. On the banks and bridges of the Seine, thousands had gathered to watch, drawn to the catastrophe and to the moment of communion. People were spreading the news on their phones. Some were singing Hail Mary. We were visitors, but for most of the crowd this was home, and a piece of their hearts seemed to be dying. Now, 5.5 years later, Notre Dame has been brought back to life. In early December, the Archbishop of Paris is scheduled to celebrate a festive mass in the restored church. That week, the great doors will open to the public and offer a measure of healing to what has been a public trauma. National Geographic was granted special access to the years of work by architects, craftspeople, and scientists that has led to this moment. In the summer of 2021, I returned for the first time since the fire as the reconstruction was about to begin. This past summer, I went back again to witness its final stage and also to learn about the clergy's plan for Notre Dame. I came to appreciate the great lengths thousands of people have gone to, not only to preserve this exquisite medieval monument, but also to revive it as a living church. There had never been a doubt that Notre Dame would be rebuilt, but what form would it take? After the fire, French President Emmanuel Macron decreed that the cathedral should be restored, more beautiful than ever. He set an ambitious goal to have the work completed by 2024 and financed by the 846 million euros that have been donated since the disaster. Macron suggested that something structurally new would be nice instead of the same old spire. Architects responded eagerly with far-fetched ideas for a glass roof or a crystal spire. Preservationists were appalled, including Chief Architect of Historic Monuments, Philippe Villeneuve, who at the time of the fire was already leading a renovation of parts of Notre Dame. From Villeneuve's perspective, adding a modern spire would have been like giving Mona Lisa a nose job, whereas restoring Notre Dame as it was, architectural historian Jean-Michel Linaud told me back in 2021. With limestone, oak, and lead would be a cathartic act, I should say, a way to purge the grim memory of that night and to grieve the loss of the original structures. In the end, the preservationists won. Notre Dame has been rebuilt exactly as it was before the fire and as it was left in the 19th century by Eugène Emmanuel Viollet de Leduc, a pioneer of restoration. We don't have the right to touch it. We're restoring it, Villeneuve said. We have no trace of our passage. Yet inside the cathedral, to anyone who has visited before, will seem utterly transfigured, brighter than any person alive has ever seen it. Walls, stained glass, paintings, and sculptures have all been cleaned and restored all at once for the first time since the 19th century. Visitors will be stupefied, awestruck by the interior of the cathedral, said Philippe Jost, president of the special public authority overseeing the restoration. It will be a shock, he added. But the interior will be new in another way. While the building is owned and managed by the French state as a protected historic monument, the interior furnishings, which were extensively damaged in the fire, were for the most part not historic, and they belonged to the Roman Catholic Diocese of Paris. Church officials chose to undertake a complete redecoration. The cost is small in the context of the overall restoration, but it will have a big effect on how visitors experience the church. Early this past summer, I paid a visit to the foundry in the Rhone Valley to see some of the church's new furnishings. There I met Guillaume Bardet, a sculptor and designer who had been commissioned by the diocese to create a new altar and other liturgical objects. In the furnace room, we watched two workers in visors and heavy aprons decant molten white-hot bronze into a series of molds. Rough, unfinished sections of Bardet's new baptismal font set on the floor nearby. His altar stood in the next room, waiting to be polished. Working with clay models, he explained he had searched for shapes that felt simple and immutable. The bronze altar is massive and looks rooted to the spot, yet its curved sides evoke a pair of uplifted arms. The hope is that it will speak not only to the faithful, but also to the large number of tourists who are unfamiliar with Catholicism or even Christianity. They, too, have to understand, Bardet said. They have to understand that what we're talking about is sacred. A week later, when I walked into the nave of the church, I found it hard at first to appreciate the beauty of the place. It was still a busy construction site. All around us, workers were dismantling, scaffolding, stringing electrical cable, polishing the marble floor. Our small group made our way deeper into the cathedral, craning our necks to take in the soaring vaults, and crossed the transept into the choir at the east end of the church. In the side chapels there, we could see the sumptuously refreshed wall paintings, which date to Viollet-le-Duc's 19th century restoration. Outside one chapel, a lone restorer knelt on the stone, her back turned to the swirl of activity. She was applying dabs of pink with a fine brush to a column painted with trefoils. This confined space, some 250 different companies employing 2,000 workers, have managed to collaborate and work in sequence over the span of the project. It's functioned because people are happy and proud to be working at Notre Dame, Jost explained. We walked outside and then entered an elevator that carried us through the scaffolding to the top of the north transept, where we emerged in the church's attic. We were above the ceiling vaults now, in a place not accessible to the public. In the part of the church that was most ravaged by the fire and where much of the work done over the past 5 years has been concentrated. Looking up, we saw blue sky through timber trusses that hadn't yet been covered with lead roofing. We picked our way through crowded walkways to the crossing, where the two arms of the transept meet, the nave and the choir. The base of the collapsing spire had plunged through the stone vaults here, then crushed the main altar on the floor below. Stonemasons had only recently closed the jagged hole in the vaults. The smell of fresh wood wafted off the oak beams and spiral stairs of the new spire. Pressing on in the attic of the nave, we entered the new forest of triangular oak roof trusses. To replicate the original medieval roof, the construction workers had relied on ancient techniques. They hand-hewn the massive timbers with traditional hand axes, which had themselves been forged by hand. The beams were then fixed in a complicated lattice with pegged mortise and tenon joints, and one of the carpenters, Hank Silver, an American who moved to France for this project, grabbed a protruding peg and hung his weight from it to demonstrate its strength. Silver directed my eye down to the nave along the center line of the new trusses. The line was slightly curved. That deformity had been in the medieval original, and the architects decided to replicate it. Silver explained that it made things even more complicated for everybody. The new framework does include one important concession to modernity. Fire protection. Fire-resistant trusses at the crossing will isolate the spire and the two transept arms from the nave and the choir, so a fire can never again race through the entire attic. Should flames break out in this space, misters distributed throughout the attic will help suppress them until firefighters can climb hundreds of stairs. Exiting the attic at the front of the church, we spiraled up the narrow stone stairs of the south tower, passing the balcony that Viollet-le-Duc had populated with grotesque creatures. At the top of the tower, we circled around to the east. The Seine, swimmable again but still brown, rolled and sparkled in the late morning sun. From the choir at the far end of the church, we could hear roofers hammering lead panels into place. The architect's decision to use lead, especially after the fire had spread that toxic material all over the cathedral and even outside it, excited a public controversy, but the preservationists insisted that it was more durable and impermeable than the alternatives and that the elaborate ornamentation could not be reproduced without it. We were eye level now with the new spire inside and out. It's a faithful copy of Viollet-le-Duc's intricate creation, made from his 19th century drawings. The one exception is the gilded brass rooster at the pinnacle, which we could see glinting in the sun. It's Villeneuve's own design. The replacement was hoisted into place in December 2023. It carries inside it relics of two Parisian saints and a scroll naming all 2,000 restoration workers. It carries symbolic meaning, too. The rooster is a symbol of French identity, of hope and resurrection. And in this case, since Villeneuve gave his bird flame-shaped wings of a cathedral rising from the ashes. The original was badly battered from its fall during the fire, but was salvaged and will be displayed as a memorial of that night. As we made our way back down from the tower, we crossed in front of the great organ on the balcony inside the front wall. It survived the fire, but had to be completely dismantled and cleaned, and for months, tuners had been calibrating the 8,000 pipes one by one. With our backs to the towering pipes, we looked out at the walls and vaults of the nave. The stained glass glowed once again in the high windows. The soot from the fire, the lead, and the filth of the ages had been stripped from the stone walls, leaving them bright and creamy. With keystones in gold leaf and ribs delicately outlined in rich burgundy, the vaults looked impeccable. My greatest satisfaction is that you can't tell the vaults that collapsed when were rebuilt, Villeneuve told me. There's a lot to like about the restoration, said Leonette, the historian, but the brutal peeling of the walls, latex was sprayed on them and then peeled off in part to extract the lead, has left the stones so white that some will feel the cathedral has lost elements of its sacred character. It will take 40 years of grime and condensation before we see those grays that the eyes can appreciate, Leonard said. To church officials, Notre Dame's sacredness derives not so much from the building itself as from what goes on inside it. The cathedral is above all a place of worship, said Monsignor Olivier Rabadou Dumas, who was built for the glory of God. Now, Rabadou Dumas is the rector of Notre Dame, meaning he runs the place when it's open. He's expecting a record $15 million to come to Notre Dame in 2025, and he doesn't like to call them tourists. The word visitor is a better fit for what he anticipates they'll experience. Once inside, he hopes a visitor just might become a pilgrim. The redecoration is designed to facilitate that. In addition to sculptor Bardet's liturgical furnishings, there will be 1,500 new chairs of solid oak. With low backs gently curved at the top, they'll be like a calm sea that accentuates the verticality of the vaults, designer Iona Vautrin told me. New lighting, on the other hand, will do much more than illuminate the architect, said the light sculptor, Patrick Rimaud. He's deploying a programmable array of 1,550 LED spotlights, each of which can vary in intensity and hue according to the season and what service is being held in the cathedral. A shadowy candlelit atmosphere on the vigil of Easter, for example, could give way to a joyous illumination on Easter morning. What's important is to treat the cathedral as a living place, Rimaud said. After the fire, the clergy debated creating a little space in the choir where Catholics could attend Mass in peace, among themselves and away from the visitors. At the end, they decided the opposite. All Masses will be celebrated at the main altar in the nave, with no barriers to keep tourists from wandering into the congregation. We have prioritized the demonstration of faith over the tranquility of prayer, Rabadou Dumas told me. The side chapels, which had been a hodgepodge, will become a pilgrim's way that gives a coherent account in painting and sculpture of the Catholic faith. From the entrance in the center of the west facade, visitors will move along the north aisle, where each chapel will be devoted to an Old Testament prophet. Then around the perimeter of the choir, which will recount the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, and finally along the south chapels of the nave, each of which will introduce a saint who embodies a particular value of the Catholic Church. A smartphone app will explain it all in multiple languages. In the apse at the far end of the church, visitors will pass on one of the most treasured relics in Christendom. The crown of thorns said to have been placed on Jesus' head before the crucifixion. Notre Dame never advertised its presence much. Architect Sylvain Debusson was commissioned to design the new reliquary to display the crown more prominently, to magnify something that's of an incredible humility, he said. The artifact is dried out, woven wreath of rushes from which the thorns were long ago removed. Debusson's solution is a 12-foot-high, 8.5-foot-wide altarpiece of cedar. At the center is a glass hemisphere whose curved back surface will be painted dark blue but lit in such a way that the surface isn't apparent. Looking into it will be like looking into an infinite sky. The crown will hang within it. On the night of the fire, the crowds along the Seine had no idea what was happening inside the cathedral. We couldn't see the firefighters racing up into the North Bell Tower just in time to save it from a collapse that might have brought down the whole building. We couldn't see the firefighters and church officials entering the burning structure to save the crown of thorns and other priceless artifacts, which for the past few years have been kept safe in a vault in the Louvre. By December, they will have been returned to their rightful home. As National Geographic went to press, Paris officials had still not completed their investigation into what might have caused the fire. Perhaps it was some kind of electrical short circuit. On Saturday, December 7th, the French state will return the restored cathedral to the Archbishop of Paris. The Archbishop will bang on the doors with his large staff, and they will open once again to the world. The great organ will wake up and blast a hymn of thanks. When you walk into Notre Dame, the first thing you'll see will be Bardet's bronze baptismal font, a portal to the Catholic faith. His new altar will be visible at the crossing under the new spire. In a society in which we're often tempted by despair, reopening the cathedral is a sign of hope, Rabbi Dumas said. That moment should be as powerful and memorable, he said, as the sight of Notre Dame on fire was to the millions who saw it in Paris and around the planet. It will be a kind of gust of joy that will, I hope, fill the world. Quite an impressive story there about the restoration of Notre Dame. There are all kinds of color graphs that go along with this article, and I wish we had time to read them all. There's 2,000 statues and decorative features that were restored. Also, 43,000 square feet of lead to cover the roof, and 2,400 oak trees felled to rebuild the spire and the roof framework, just to name some of the things from some of these graphics. And as we mentioned, the spire's copper rooster was found crumpled in rubble, and items inside the gilded one with its wings of flame include a scroll naming the restoration workers who were involved. And by the way, it took roughly 1,000 wood pieces that collapsed in the inferno that required 660 tons of scaffolding just to replace the spire alone. Quite a story, and there's so much more. But time is out, and we have to end today's journey on Armchair Traveler. We certainly hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice, all one word, .org. Now, any comments or questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.